You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So we're going to be speaking sort of around the principles and the subjects in Steve's brilliant book. Anyone already got this book?
There you go. Two people. Thank you.
So those that haven't, I would highly recommend it. It's a wonderful book, and I'm just going to tell a very quick story about this book and my connection with it. And I'm going to say it before Steve does, because he always says it in a way that's very embarrassing to me. So I'm going to speak because I've got the mic. So beginning of last year, Steve very kindly sent me an early copy PDF of this book and asked me, would I be up for reading it and writing a review about it? So I said, yeah, it's very nice of you to ask. I'll read it. So I saved it and read it on a plane journey to Ireland. What I hadn't realised was that literally every single page would land with me in such an emotional, strong way. So I got to the airport and I tried to start leaving Steve a voice note. I love voice notes. And the first voice note I left was a few minutes long. And by the time I got to the end of it, I was very emotional. So I said to him, "Look, I'm going to leave you another voice note tomorrow with my thoughts on your book, because the person picking me up from the airport wonder why I'm crying, basically." So I left it overnight and I recorded a voice note, which I think was about 20 minutes long, explaining to Steve why this book landed with me so well and the timing of it and all the things in it that resonate with me. And I mentioned in that message I lived in Slough. He then rang me, long story short, and it turned out that Steve had been attempting to do some work in Slough, and all of the principles in this book were playing out and had played out, and it all came to light. So we'll talk a bit more about that, but that's my introduction to this book.
Yeah, and my little take on that. now Julie's told you what actually happened is I'd got these two voice notes from Julie. You know, the first one that, as Julie's just described, ends with tears, though I didn't know that at the time. And then this second one, which was even longer than the first one. And like, you know, when do you get the time to listen to a voice note that's like going to take you most part of half an hour? You know, so it went for a couple of weeks probably, didn't it? When I didn't respond, and it was only because I didn't have half an hour to listen to this thing. But I was on a train journey with my friend Joy, and I said, "Joy, do you mind if I don't speak to you at all? And I just put my headphones in and listen to this voice note from Julie." So I went through this whole kind of journey from you starting quite bright and ending up sobbing, you know, kind of like, and then putting the phone down and then coming back and then, but the thing is this, so this is what this book is about. And it's about the empowerment of you, right? I had been working with a local council for over half a decade. They had invited me at Oasis, the charity I began, to come and work in their community, in one of their poorest wards in Slough. They said, "It's the poorest ward. Will you come and work there?" So I had come with somebody else from Oasis over the course of about 5 years. We'd been constantly going to this community, which is called Britwell. And I'd sat in the community centre that was opened by the Queen, which is really plush, and met with the council endlessly, with the NHS, with the police, with the fire. And I'm not knocking any of the wonderful people I met, you know. But nothing happened. They even put me on a board, didn't they? A board of what's called the Integrated Care Service. Some of you who work in the NHS will know about integrated care systems. And I'm still a formal member of this board. Right. Well, we went, this is before the lockdowns, then we went all the way through the lockdowns and we came out the other side of the lockdowns and we're still meeting, I'm still going to these board meetings. And in the end, I asked if I could meet the chair of the board and the vice chair of the board and a team's call. And I rang them up and I said, "Look, I've got to leave. I've got to leave because I spend so much of my time coming to Britwell and so much of my time doing lectures round the country because you recommended me to other ICSs, integrated care systems that exist to bring people together in a community and make stuff happen." And I said, "And the thing is this, nothing has ever happened. Like nothing, not one thing ever anywhere has actually taken place as the result of all the hours and hours and hours hours and days and months we spent. And I said, and I love you, because I do love them, because the NHS, as you know, and all of these wonderful welfare systems, they're filled with fantastic people that find the system even more frustrating than the people that are trying to use the services. So I said, we can't be involved anymore. We just got to, you know, break off our engagement. You know, kind of, we got to do this. Anyway, then I phoned Julie from her text messages, and she said, I live in a community just like the communities you're describing. And I said, so where is that? Because I never knew where Julie lived, you know. She said, I live in a place called Britwell. And I've been trying to work with the council for years and years and years, and they don't do anything. And so then we talked to them together, didn't we? So we, you know, renewed ambition. We talked to them again. They're lovely people. Honestly, they're lovely people, aren't they? And they still said in the end, yeah, well, if we were going to work with you, didn't they, it would have to go out to procurement. And I said, but we've been working with you for 7 years. And Julie lives there. And she's lived there for 20. Oh, no, procurement is what we need. And that's not, I'm not a slight on the wonderful people. Don't, they're just following the rules. You know, so in the end, what we decided is, oh, bugger it. We're going to, we decided we'd just do it together, didn't we? So Oasis now employs Julie. Julie's joined Oasis. We got going. Julie organised this big event to launch the stuff in the very centre where we used to have all these meetings. And this is about you, Julie, isn't it? Everyone rocked up, the NHS, everybody, to get their pictures taken and say, we're really part of this thing.
So I think, yeah, and I think that it's been interesting. We've already done more, I'd say, in 5 months than they managed to do in 5 years. But, of course, the key to that is...
Which isn't saying a lot, to tell you the truth.
But I think the principles in this book, you know, lay out all of this stuff. This book is full of Steve's experience and all of those other wonderful people in Oasis and all of these sorts of things, which any of you working in communities, local government, the NHS, I'm sure you'll recognise some of this stuff. As Steve said, you know, all great people, but the system just locks everybody in. And what's missing, and what was missing in that example and is missing so often, are the real people, the local people who end up not actually having a say. I remember the first phone call we had with them, and they started talking about, as they sort of opened up, you know, body language. It was very closed at the beginning of the call, and by the time we'd done our bit for about 10 minutes, you could see them sort of open up. But then they started talking about maybe doing something to do with weight loss, and it was so irrelevant to what is the problem in the local area. I almost didn't know whether to laugh or cry when she said it. I thought, are you really for real that you're going to kind of come and land again in the estate, do your thing and go again? And it isn't actually engaging local people. None of the local people that I've spoken to knew about any of these meetings. And it's not a very big area. So I think what really resonated with this book, and, you know, for me, it was God's plan and the timing of it that we actually met. I mean, we already knew each other before, but in other fancy places like the House of Commons and stuff. We'd never actually, Steve didn't know that I lived in Slough when he was coming there. And so what you'll find in this book is, and certainly for me, you know, you can't argue with the people that walk the walk, which is what Steve and Oasis absolutely do on a everyday basis. And Steve has been doing since he set Oasis up almost 40 years ago. So you can't argue with the real stuff when people actually get out and do the thing and speak to the people. And principle one in this book is based around 10 principles. And principle one says, an ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory. And Steve, why don't you just talk a bit about kind of where this book came from, the two boys and the, you know, the experiences that you had there.
So Oasis, we do a lot. I began Oasis, but it's now a huge movement. In this country, we employ getting on for 6,000 people, and we run 54 schools. And last week, we opened an alternative to a youth jail. We've been working on that since 2010. And last Wednesday, the first young person arrived with us because... as you know, we have a justice system that doesn't offer justice. Yeah. Yeah, a penal system. You know, we have the worst reoffending rate in Europe. I don't know if you know that. Because we don't work therapeutically with someone. We don't say, you know, we don't say what's happened to you. We just say we're going to punish you. I mean, you punish somebody into being a criminal. You know, you can't heal somebody by hurting them, all this kind of. So that's what Oasis has grown to be. But I've learned loads of lessons, you know, mostly through making giant mistakes along the way. You learn through your failures, don't you? Your screw-ups and all that kind of thing. But what happened to us to trigger this book, it was New Year's Eve in 2021, you know. And at 7 o'clock on the day before New Year's Eve, we run some schools in Croydon, which is where I grew up. We run 6 schools, primary schools, secondary schools, lots of other stuff as well. And one of our students at 7 o'clock on the day before Christmas Eve, 7 o'clock in the evening, was stabbed to death in a park just where near where I grew up. It's called Ashburton Park. He was stabbed to death, stabbed through the heart. And he was stabbed because he saw some other kids who'd been excluded from a school dealing drugs to some younger kids who went to our school. And he called to them and told them to get away. And the result was that the kids that were dealing the drugs, one of them chased him and stabbed him fatally. He died. So I get that news that evening. The next morning, I got up and we run some schools in the city of Oldham. And I got a message early in the morning. One of our staff phoned me and said, "Steve, some bad news. This morning, Dylan, a 5-year-old student in our primary school, was found dead in his home when the police raided his home on a big housing estate. And his mother has been arrested for his murder." So those two things happened within 24 hours. And in both of those situations, I knew that if only we'd been left to get on with things, I mean accountable, but actually do stuff, neither of those things would have happened. I know that in Croydon, we'd applied 9 years earlier to run an empty building and turn it into a youth centre, yards from where this young man was stabbed to death. Yards. It would have been lit up. It would have been alive. We'd been working with these kids. I knew that we'd applied for money in Oldham to work with the families of the children in our school. You can't just work with the child as though they're somebody isolated. I knew all of that. And I knew all of that because of the first principle in this book. An ounce of common sense is worth more than a ton of theory. Do you know, the way that we learn in life is by doing stuff, isn't it? And we've been converted to this view. If we just sit remote from an issue and we sit in the government building, whether it's a local government or, you know, Downing Street or Whitehall, you know, we'll work out how to do these things. The distance between the decision makers and the ground is, you can measure the irrelevance of what happens by that distance, in my view. So we've been turned down for grants and money had been wasted. I'm not saying because they didn't give it to Oasis. I'm saying common sense tells you a lot more than theory. One example of that, and then we talk about how this works out in Britwell. But there's a government minister, not a government minister now, he used to be the Secretary of State for Education. They were a lot of those, as you know. But he was the first one with the coalition government, and he kind of still knocking around. His first name's Michael. But then, and this government minister, in the dying days of the last government, the last, you know, 12 months of it, he said that what you got to do to get kids back in school, we know about persistent absence, don't we? A huge issue. 20% of children in our country are missing huge chunks of their education because it's irrelevant to them, and mental health issues and all sorts of things. He said, what we got to do is start fining parents who do not send their children to school all the time. Well, that's been out there forever, do you know? But we're going to fine them more, you know? So that's the theory. Of course, we know it doesn't work, but here's the practice. In one of our schools, a school that we became responsible for, there was a girl who there was a girl who rarely attended. She'd been great at attendance, secondary school, but she stopped attending. When she did turn up, she'd turn up late. When she did turn up, she'd turn up, you know, not dressed in the right gear with the right shoes and the right uniform. And when she did turn up, half the time she smelled bad. And she was given more and more detentions in this school because you turn up late, you're late, detention, you're late, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that went on and on and on and on and on. And we became responsible for the school, and the new head, in hearing all of this and a detention record and a suspension record, sat down with her and had a cup of coffee in a break time. And here's her story. 2 years earlier, her father had died of a massive heart attack. He was fit as a fiddle. One morning, he was dead. She had two younger siblings. Her father's death impacted her mum's mental health. Her mum fell apart and became an alcoholic. Every morning, this girl got up, looked after her mum, who'd often vomit overnight in her bed, get her mum out of bed, clean her mum up, shower her mum, change her mum's bed, then go get her two younger siblings up, get them washed, give them breakfast, get them dressed, make them sandwiches, take them to their primary school, leave them there, and then make a decision. The decision whether to go into school herself or to go back to her mum, depending on her mum's mental, emotional state. Sometimes she chose to go back to her mum and come into school later. Sometimes she felt she had to spend the whole day with her mum. When that story is told, it changes everything. An ounce of common sense that you gain on the ground through the work that you're doing and through your churches and, you know, the groups that you're part of is worth more than tons of tons of policy that's put together far, far from where it becomes reality. That's true in Britwell, isn't it?
Yeah, so one thing that comes to mind when Steve was talking about the boy who was stabbed, and around about sort of 2019, I had started to, as I mentioned, I do work all over the country, but I had this kind of what I think was like a calling back to saying to me, do some work again in Slough where I live. And trying to navigate the town and the politics and the people. And for me, trust is really, really important. Who can I trust? Who can I work with? I'm not bothered who they are, but who, you know, where can I find myself useful? And in September, so almost coming up 5 years now, next month, a boy, 15-year-old, Elton, was stabbed in the park in our town by another 15-year-old. And even now I feel emotional about it because 15, they were like babies. And he really did look so young as well when, you know, he died. And there were all the other boys around and turned out they were friends and it all went wrong and they had a knife, etc. And I remember at the time my instinctive reaction was for us to try and organise an event, a coming together straight away, like the week after. It seemed so obvious to me. Everyone was worried. The parents were starting to worry. Is this going to, you know, are we going to start getting stabbings like they do in other places? And it was very scary for parents. I've got boys similar sorts of age and I know how it feels. So I remember saying, let's just organise an event. And the council, I found a local councillor two women who got it straight away, both mothers, and understood what I was trying to say. Let's just meet and bring everyone together and cry and do whatever we need to do and work out, is there something more we can do to stop this from ever happening again? The council literally stopped them from doing an event, said to them, you're not allowed to hire a hall or do anything. For, as a resident, as a mother, it made me angry and very upset because I just thought, what are you talking about? It's them trying to be official about things and not wanting to own the problem because it's just too difficult. But those boys, both of them lived in Slough. One of them's now in prison. right? And his family and all the fallout. And I've met both mothers since then. And his mum, Elton's mum, said to me, and is angry, and still goes to his grave every single day, by the way, even till now. And it's part of her daily routine. It's heartbreaking, actually, in every single way. But she told me how she had tried to say to the authorities. So she isn't one of these, a mother who's saying, no, my boy was an angel. She was already saying to them, something has gone wrong for him in secondary school. He was really good in primary. He's got in with the wrong people. You need to help me. And she feels like no one helped her when she was saying, he's going out late. I don't know what to do. I'm helpless. What can no one helped her. So she then had to deal with that. So I saw all of this stuff play out, even in just that one incident. There's lots of others. But it made me realize that sometimes, and one of the things that I really want to say to all of the people here, I don't know what all of the different works and jobs and community stuff you will do, but there will be people here. Sometimes you feel that you have to go with the system and you don't. Some of us have to, and I think Steve has demonstrated all of his life as someone who just does what he knows is the right thing to do. And actually, guess what? People catch up. Like he said, you know, he's been coming to these meetings for 5 years, said, I'm not doing it anymore. Now we've created something and we're creating a hub, an oasis hub in my area. Now everyone wants a bit of it. All of the services are coming. All of them want to be part of it. And obviously I could just be bitter about it. There's no point. You know, it's a great feeling, actually, that we're doing the work that they all should have done. You know, people working full time on some of this stuff. And I was just doing it in off my own, not a job, not a role, nothing. Just meeting the people, connecting the dots. And the other thing to say is that there are organisations and groups like schools, for example. I was fortunate to hang out with some of the principals from some of the Oasis schools recently. And they absolutely do see themselves as community leaders. But that isn't always the case for teachers and head teachers. They don't always see that connection with their local area. And certainly in my area, we've got a secondary school and two primary schools that I'm now working with. And of course, straight away, all brilliant people. As soon as they have someone like me who's linked in with the local area and the residents, of course they want to be involved because all of their families live in our area. So of course there's a direct connection between a school and the local estate or wherever the families are coming from. And they know that there's only so much they can do in school when the kids are out of school and all the home stuff and all the problems that parents have got. You need a joined up approach, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I just said we ought to move on, but let me just say that Oasis is responsible for a church in central London. It's called Oasis Church Waterloo. And it was 21 years ago that I went and volunteered myself as the minister. Oasis was up and running. And so I've always felt it's good for me if I, instead of existing at this level kind of thing, you get stuck in. I'd say unless you understand everything in microcosm in at least one place, you never really understand any macro things. You've got to be doing it. You know, you've got to be sweeping the floor, putting the chairs away. You've got to be turning up to set the PA system out or whatever it is. You know, sitting, talking with people, that's what keeps you on the ground, isn't it? So, but once we have macro thinking that's detached from micro understanding in at least one place, we get lost. Anyway, what happened was, so I became in my spare time, the minister of this church. Basically, there were only 10 people in the church. So the church was bankrupt and I'm Baptist minister and it's a Baptist church. And I was free because I didn't need any money. So there wasn't much of a application process. It was, you know, kind of like, can you come? Because we're sinking, you know. Anyway, the point was, so we started off and this girl, so I got to know people on the estate and all the rest of it. And a girl called Harriet, on a Friday night, she had a brain hemorrhage. And on the Saturday morning, she was 12 years old. On the Saturday morning, Harriet died in the local hospital. It's called St. Thomas's. And the little band of volunteers I'd got working with me by then, or I was working with them, we didn't know Harriet, we didn't know her family, and they just heard about it. And they said, there's nothing we can do about this. And I said to them, there's everything we can do. So what we did was put together some flowers, and I, with somebody else, we went to Harriet's door. We found out where she lived, and we knocked on the door, and her mum answered and was in tears, and we gave in the flowers and said, do you know, I told her, you know, I were around the corner from you. We won't stay, but if ever we can be of any help to you, we will. And you have our prayers, whatever they're worth, and our care, whatever it's worth. Well, the funeral took place. They were a family that were heavily Catholic in a cultural way. And then afterwards, the mum asked me to go and have tea with her. So I went and had tea. And she said, I just feel so bereaved and so lost. And, you know, after a funeral, you always get that feeling. Building up to a funeral, there's stuff to do. It's the day after that you plunge, isn't it? So I said to her, why don't we put together a huge celebration of Harriet's life? And we get her school choir to come and sing. She was in secondary school. And we get the primary school to come and put something together. And we get the whole community into this. And why don't we raise a fund to create something in Harriet's memory? It was a pool table we decided that we'd get, you know, because I just inherited this old church building, which didn't have any chairs, let alone a pool table. And kind of like, so we all agreed. And we set it for about, I don't know, 2 months hence. And the whole community worked at it together. All worked at it together. And they raised all the money for a pool table and a load of money as well, other than that. And then the building was packed out and both schools came and loads of community members came. And I knew that besides honouring Harriet's memory and comforting her family, that was the moment of ignition. That was the moment of ignition. If we build community, who knows what it will lead on to? So now that church, Oasis Church Waterloo, it runs a children's centre, a primary school, a secondary school, a sixth form, an advice centre. We do legal support, immigration support, relationship support, money management and debt support. We run the local library. We work in the accident and emergency department of the local hospital. We run a community farm. We employ in Waterloo hundreds of people. I haven't got a clue how many people we employ in Waterloo. I guess it's about 200, 250, something like that. All sparked by taking the opportunity of being there. So we can all do this in our communities.
Yeah. As you can imagine, when you're doing a session with Steve, you have a plan. And then you kind of have to just... So we've only done the first bit of our plan. We had a little bit of a plan, didn't we? But it's all good, right? The point is, this is what I mean. This is the real stuff, the stories. You know, the reason that Steve can talk about all of these things literally for hours is because he's been there, done it, got the T-shirt and walked the walk. But I think the example that Steve has just given illustrates really well what I was saying just now, in a way, to sort of all of you, because all of you know your own circumstances and your own patch that you're in and whatever you're able to do. And I guess when we come to something like Greenbelt, we have to think about what we're going to sort of take away and do differently, or how we're going to be a better person or whatever it is. I certainly do. I love coming here. I feel very at home here. But so all of you have to think about your own, and in the context of this book and the principles and all of that, what can you do differently? And what Steve has just illustrated there is, you know, can you imagine if we waited for all of the lights to be green with the authorities and all of that, all of the things that he's just talked about wouldn't be happening. I've been to that place in Waterloo. I sat in the library. There's kind of like a coffee shop area. And one of the things that they do there is they have youth workers, and the kids can come in after school because there's a school connected to it, and just get free squash and biscuits and whatever. And of course, from a youth worker's perspective, it's like a dream, because they're not there doing a youth club. They're just there serving the tea and drink, but they get a sense of where the young people are at and what they're doing. So you don't have to over-formalize all of these things, but if you wait for the council and the local authority and all of that, often a lot of this stuff just won't happen.
Yeah. So there's 10 principles in the book, but we're only going to talk about 3, you'll be pleased to know. And the next one we're going to talk about, which, Julie, you can talk about it, Rumi. I'm sure many of you know Rumi, this great Muslim scholar, poet, theologian, scholar. He once said, where there's ruin, there's hope. And that's principle two. And I guess that applies to Britwell, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But I think that the problem is, of course, especially nowadays, it's very easy for people to think, come on, you know, what are you talking about? How can we have hope? A lot of people feel hopeless right now, right? And there's a word in Arabic, tawakkal, which means kind of reliance on God, tawakkal. And I think that part of this is that as well, and also seeing the good in people. You know, any of you who work in local communities will know it's so easy to write off an area like mine. I live there. My kids have been born and brought up there. And so many, of course, hundreds and thousands of other people also. And it's so easy to write off an area like that and to just make people feel. So, you know, for the young people who live in my area, how easy is it for them to make themselves or for others to make them feel that they don't matter and that they don't count? And of course, you know, anyone can do anything with the right support and the right arm around the shoulder, which is why I mean about the link up between schools and the local communities and community groups and just joining the dots. That's what I see myself doing, really, just joining the dots up and giving people that hope. One of the things I wanted to ask you, Steve, which we haven't really talked about in a session like this before because the government's only just come in, but how are you feeling about this government?
I was going to say that after you talked about hope locally. I think there's hope nationally. I really do. So that's not that's a political statement with a small p, not a big p. So I'm old enough to have lived through two, as an adult, through two massive transitions. I Oasis was young-ish. I mean, we were about 15 years old. So we, I suppose, when Tony Blair's, I began Oasis in 1985. Tony Blair's government came to 97, wasn't it? So basically, I'd been running Oasis long enough by then to realise that there was a big moment of transition coming, you know? And effectively, what happened, I won't bore you with the story, because these things always happen through putting yourself out there. Do you know, I'd say to you, as a principle that's not in the book, cross the room, begin the conversation, smile at someone. Do you know, most British people frown naturally. I'm looking at you, you know, kind of like, you know, we just frown naturally. You know, very few people smile naturally. Being a preacher, I know this, because you're that on a stage, you're talking and everybody looks so miserable. And then you go stand at the door and think, please, Lord, beam me up. I don't want to face all these people who have hated what I've been saying. And there's the guy with the most miserable looking face all the way through the thing. And he comes up to you and he says, oh, that was wonderful. And you kind of like, so cross the floor, talk to people. They're not as scary as you think, and get to know them anyway. So I won't tell you a story of how that happened, but I did. And then in a long, 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 long roundabout way, I got to know Tony Blair, who wasn't the Prime Minister. He wasn't anything. I mean, he was just a bloke called Tony Blair, you know. And then he introduced me to his wife called Cherie. And, you know, we chatted together and he gave me his mobile phone number and I gave him mine and all that. Then lo and behold, he turned out to be the Prime Minister a few years later. So I rang him up, you know, I mean, because, you know, and I said, you know, you've got this thing going on about schools and starting these things called academies. And he actually, honestly, this is what happened. He said, oh, I was going to ring you about that. Because I told him about how we ran schools in India. I'm half Indian. And he said, I was just wondering if you might be able to run one here. And so that's how we got into running schools, you know. So it was that moment of opportunity. Then, years and years later, came the coalition government. Labour was tired. You know, they were broken. They'd run out of ideas. They needed time on the back benches, to tell you the truth, in opposition, to just reform and recoup and re-energise and think new thoughts. And I knew that the coalition, well, I didn't know it'd be a coalition, but I knew a new government was coming. And that minister I talked about, whose first name is Michael, he was hoping to be the Secretary of State for Education, which he did effectively become. So here's the thing. He rang me up, right? He wasn't the Secretary of State for Education. He was just the shadow, do you know? And Conservatives have been in opposition for donkey's years. And so he came and had lunch with me a couple of times, and, you know, with a SPAD special advisor, and they scribble down everything you're saying, but you know it's a moment that only lasts a little bit. Do you see? That's with the Labour government. Where, you know, it's like when I was a kid, I had a friend called John Dean. And when we were 10, I used to live in South Norwood, Croydon. And John Dean always had more courage than I had. And they'd relayed the path in South Norwood recreation ground. And it was all wet concrete. And John stood there with me. We were still in primary school. And he said, "Steve, our moment to make history." And like, he did stuff that was so scary that I would never do. He said, "We're going to run through it." And we did. We ran through the wet path. It was, you know, we ran through the wet path and we left our footprints there. And until the day I left South Norwood, which was when I was 18, our footprints were still in the path. So what I'm saying to you is there's a moment when these big transitions happen between governments, when the concrete's wet and you can make an impact. But as that government settles in, everything gets firmer and firmer and firmer and firmer, and you can't make an impact. And it happened with Tony Blair, and it happened with the transition to what was the coalition. But here we are again. We were again. The Conservative government was tired and run out of energy and ideas, and you knew like it was time to sit in opposition and recoup. And all those Labour politicians, shadows, wanted to talk. But the concrete's not set yet. You know, the manifesto about working with kids who are persistently absent from school, working with kids that get drawn into youth violence, you know, getting people to teach in schools. But as Wes Streeting says, the NHS is broken. Like, it needs other people to join in, voluntary groups, social prescribing, they call it. I've got a daughter who is a GP. She says to me, "Dad, most days no one comes to my surgery who's got anything biomedically wrong with them. They're lonely. Their relationships are broken down. They're depressed. All we can do is give them, you know, antidepressants. But they need community. They need photography clubs and chess clubs and walking clubs and walking football. And, you know, they need all of that. Now is the moment. But it will only last another few months, because policies begin to become set. Now is the moment. Truly it is. I believe that with all my heart. And I know that in Britwell, we can make footprints in the concrete before it's set. And so can you. That's what I believe.
I thought it might be good, actually, just for you to talk very briefly about Oasis Restore, which we didn't plan on, but I feel like it's really important for people to know. But the principle here, which principle 7, do things with people, not to them. And it's kind of what we've been talking about all along. And I know that our local GP practice, who I've now got, you know, I found the GP who hates bureaucracy, who wants to see this stuff work, who has taken himself off the similar sorts of boards to what Steve is talking about, and wants to, as people come in the building, the GP surgery is there and everything else is there. And they took it over with the view that they want less people going left and more people benefiting from the community that's supposed to be there, that at the moment is pretty much non-existent in our area. Beautiful building wrapped up in a whole load of red tape and bureaucracy. Very frustrating, but I am very determined to unpack that building and get it buzzing and going in the way that the GP wants. So, of course, the GPs don't want people going to them with the loneliness, and that they need to be able to, people need to benefit from others. And that is just about joining the dots. That's about cutting through the red tape. It's about people like us doing things. It's so brilliant to not be part of the system, but be open to working with the system. You can't turn your back on it. Is what it is. There's so much good. There's so many good people. Of course, there's money, and it's not about money. The NHS has money, of course. Anyone working in the NHS, when there's a lot of wasted money. So it's just about unlocking and doing that, but with people. And I keep on saying at every single meeting, I will use the word evangelical. I'm evangelical about saying to them, you have to put residents at the heart of everything you're doing. Otherwise, none of this is going to have any long-term benefit. You need to train people up. You need to let people make mistakes. You need to listen to their ideas. Any of you working with volunteers know how difficult it is to get stuff, but it can be amazing. So that's really, for me, what this principle is about. It's 1:10. We have till 1:30, and it would be really good to have some conversation. Because it's a living room. That's what we're supposed to do, right? You don't want to just sit here listening to
us. You know,
so, but just very, Steve, if you can, in like 4 or 5 minutes, just introduce Oasis Restore, and then people can go up and look it up, because it is actually amazing.
So what happened was, when the coalition government came in, remember David Cameron said he was going to build the big society? Do you remember all that talk about getting doing things with people?
Yeah,
we are the most centralised country in the whole of Western Europe. Did I talk about that in our book a bit? And report after report says do things with people. I mean, going right back to William Beveridge in setting up the NHS, I talk about this in my books, so I haven't got time to talk about it. Beveridge, in the end, said before the NHS started, and remember, it was the Beveridge Report in 1942 that brought about the welfare system that was state and the NHS. NHS was set up July 5th, 1948. In 1946, 2 years before it was set up, he delivered a second report, that was actually his third report, but a second report in terms of healthcare to the government. And he basically said, it's never going to work, you know. If you read, it's never going to work, because you reckon, all the healthcare in our country for anybody but the rich used to be run by faith groups and trade unions and community groups. And it was patchy, and it was, you know, good here and not bad there and non-existent there. But you're taking it all over, and that's not what I was suggesting. I was suggesting partnership. I was suggesting that professionals work with amateurs and community groups, and unless you do that, it will struggle and it will collapse. And Wes Streeting recently had the courage to say that it's broken. There's great opportunity. Anyway, what happened when David Cameron's doing his big society thing, I because we run a church which is just down the road from Parliament, I invited him to come and speak about the big society. So he rocked up to do his talk about the big society, and I sat next to this guy that came with him, and I had no idea why he came, thinking about it, but I sat next to this guy, we were waiting for David Cameron to come and speak, and I said to him, well, what's your name? And he said, oh, my name's Chris. I said, oh, great, my name's Steve. What do you do? And he said, well, I'm in the government. I said, oh, because they were all brand new, you know. Like, I said, well, what do you do? He said, I am the Lord Chancellor. And I just want to check. I hadn't got a clue what a Lord Chancellor is. Does anybody know what a Lord Chancellor is? You know, I had no idea. So I said, oh, that's good. Are there many? And he said, no, only me. And I said, well, what do you do? And he said, oh, well, a better way of explaining it is that I'm in charge of justice. I'm the Secretary of State for Justice. My name's Chris Grayling. And so I said, oh, that's interesting. You've got to take your opportunity with a smile. You've got to be kind, you know, not aggressive. I just smiled. And I said, we run some schools. There's not a lot of justice for most young people, is there? He said, what do you mean? And we got into a big conversation, cut a long story short. He said, why don't you come and have a meal with me? So I went to have a meal with him. Then he said, why don't you write a paper? So we wrote a paper with a friend of mine called Dave, who now runs Oasis in the UK. And we took it and we met with some officials, not him anymore, but a load of officials in the Ministry of Justice. And to cut a very long story, and it is a very long story because this was in 2010, last Wednesday night, finally, we opened Oasis Restore, which is justice for young people who've always been denied it. Oasis Restore is in Medway in Kent. Right? It's not like Feltham. It's not a youth jail. It's for kids who've been in serious trouble with the law, violent crime. And it's about understanding that we all understand now, don't we, about brain science, neuroscience. If you're not loved, if you're not seen, if you don't feel secure, if you're not soothed, as a child, your brain develops differently. You're on high alert the whole time. Your prefrontal cortex, that's the thinking part of your brain, the management center. You know, when you want to hit someone and you don't, you just say, after you, do you know, and pride yourself that aren't you a good person? No, it's simply that the experiences you've had through life and the parenting you've had, which might come from your parents or the church you're part of or the community you're part of, what it's enabled is for your prefrontal cortex that sits there. Cortex just means bark in Latin. It means the bit that wraps around your brain, and that's where you make your decisions. And in every kid in the justice system, their prefrontal cortex is very loosely attached to the rest of their brain. It's never been joined up properly by what we call synaptic connections, the wiring. And so, you know what happens to you? When you're angry, when you're upset, you know, you tend to act off your senses, don't you? You know, the more stressed I am, the more stupidly I behave. I'm sure it's not true of you, you know? The more stressed I am, the more stupidly I behave and speak. And when I calm down, I go, why did I say that? That's when my prefrontal cortex gets overloaded and I act off my sensory system instead. But if you're born into a world where this is never attached properly, all sorts of stuff goes wrong. Now, I'm not saying the kids that come into us and begun coming to us, they've done bad, bad things that have impacted the lives of others. But we have to work with people therapeutically. I suggested to the MOJ, Julie, I don't know if I've ever told you this. We called it Oasis Restore because it's about restoration. It's not about, the punishment is that these young people have had their freedom taken away. Oasis Restore, and I suggested a strap line. And the strap line was setting young people free. And the MOJ said, no, you can't say that. You can't say that. So it now says a secure future for young people, which is kind of compromise. But it took 14 years to get there, 14 years, but we opened last week. And it just shows you that you can make a difference. And the funny thing is, and then back to you, and we should invite people to talk. Funny thing is, I was saying to Danielle, who's here with me, I was talking to a very senior person in government the other day. And I was talking about other things that need to happen. There's so many things wrong with our justice system. We throw girls in with boys. It's terrible. It's terrible. We throw kids that are on remand in with kids that have been sentenced. It's terrible. Do you know? I do all sorts of things. So I was talking about all of this. And he said to me, he said, you know, what you don't realise, Steve, is you have far... I'm talking about someone up there. He said to me, you have far more power, Steve, in the system than I will ever have. And I won't tell you who it was, right? I was saying, but you are. But I also understand what he means. Everyone's in the system. And what it takes is a rebel. What it takes is someone who's going to call a spade with a smile on their face instead of doing it aggressively. But what it takes is for us activists to get involved locally, to get involved nationally. And the more you get involved in what I've discovered through the years, the more you get opportunity to be involved in. And with that, I should shut up because we've got a quarter of an hour left.
Yeah. So why don't we open it up for a living room conversation? So anyone, any ideas, thoughts, concerns? Yep. Gosh, there's lots. Okay. One here to start. Here?
There's some ladies down here.
Two here, yeah.
Thank you. That was really great to hear. Can I ask you about Oasis Restore? What do you hope, what will success look like for you? And also, what's the biggest challenge?
Yeah. So, at the moment, it depends how you do the figures, but about 67, 68% of young people who leave a youth custodial sentence reoffend within the first year. That's a formal MOJ, Ministry of Justice statistic, but it's a lie. It's not true, as I always point out to them. You know, I say it with a smile again. Because 67 or whatever it is percent of kids, that's the vast majority of them, reoffending within a first year. It's not them reoffending, it's reconvictions, it's getting caught, right? my judgment is that about 67% of kids who've been in a custodial setting reoffend within about the first 24 hours, I would have said, because you send them straight back to their community without any support. And the extraordinary thing, some of you will know, is the more vulnerable you are, the worse your situation is. If you're a looked after child in our society, do you know, 4% of children, it's under that actually, but around 4% of children in our society are looked after. It's the biggest oxymoron in the English language. They're not looked after. 4% of children make up 46, 47% of all young people in custody. Young people who've not been seen, not felt secure, not been soothed, not felt safe. And their behaviours, we may call them antisocial, but all behaviour is communication. All behaviour is communicating something that's going on inside, you know? So what we need to do is love kids. I had a bit of a fallout with a Minister of State who is no longer one because, you know, his first name was Dominic, I should say. Because he asked me, I know you probably know this, he came to see the site that we built out. Because we don't have cells, we have bedrooms. We don't have wings, we have student houses. We don't have guards, we have youth workers and teachers and health workers. There are no bars, there are windows. You know, these aren't offenders, they are students. You know, all of that kind of stuff. Changing the stuff. Well, and anyway, I was asked, and it got printed in the national press. That's what got me into trouble. I was asked what our strategy was. And I said, it's love. And then they said, it's got to be love and something. And I said, well, it's relentless love. And the reporter said, anything else? And I said, no, that's just it. Well, that didn't go down very well in some quarters, you know, because it's seen as mamby-pamby. But as I pointed out, what's mamby-pamby is to lock a kid in a cell for 20 hours a day to just fry, do you know? That's what skill does it take to lock a door and leave a child in a room endlessly? It doesn't take any skill other than knowing how to turn a key in a lock. That's it. To sit a child down. You know, I'm a grandparent now. We got 10 little grandchildren. So we know how they kick off. You know, I've got a grandchild. His name's Zephyr. He's fantastic. And he's 3. Do you know, when I was with him this week, he can go within nanoseconds from being the happiest boy on the planet to throwing himself on the ground and I'm going to end it all. It's terrible because no one will give me a lolly. You know, kind of like that. And then he bounces. You know that, don't you? Why is that? Because at the age of 3, your prefrontal cortex is the last bit of your brain to wire up and doesn't happen fully until in your 20s, actually. It doesn't happen until... So here we are. We've got a 14-year-old who sits in front... A 15-year-old sits in front of you who's tried to kill someone, do you know? Or whatever, right? And they flip. And what that little Zephyr's doing is he's testing out love, isn't he? He's finding the boundaries. I'm going to throw myself on the carpet. You know, and I'm going to see if you really love me, Mum and Dad. That's what these kids are doing. So it's really to love relentlessly isn't mamby-pamby. It's hard. But slowly you win someone's trust. And so what we're going to do is we're going to reduce the reoffending rate because it's sky high. Basically, you could say, I don't know if this been recorded. If it's been recorded, forgive me. That, right, the system at the moment, you know, the outcomes are, you know. So all we got to be is a little bit better than, and then it kind of, but we're going to be a lot better than that, if you see what I mean, right? Giving kids opportunity, that's it. And doing it therapeutically and showing that love works, whereas punishing people doesn't. Shout loud.
Biggest concern
is... You worked
is it on?
Yeah, you worked at Oak Hill and your biggest concern is...
About the children who have killed somebody and they'll come to Oasis Restore and they'll get all that love and all that wonderful work and then they'll go on into the adult system. And there are lots of kids like that.
Yes.
And I just wonder what your view is on that and what you might be doing.
So I think that Julie and I will both say, as a general rule, do you know, I remember speaking at, spoken at Greenbelt lots of times. I love coming here. And I remember somebody taking me to task on our previous occasion, and they said, you shouldn't be joining in. They weren't talking about ISIS Restore. They were talking about something else. You've got to protest. And I do believe in protest. I really believe in protest. But I go on very few protests because I think that you get more skin in the game by doing something. And you're right. There are, as I think I said, there are dozens of things wrong with the criminal justice system in our country. And I could take the rest of our time just outlining them. And one of them is that children who've been cared for therapeutically might go on into a prison that's not therapeutic at all, and everything's being undone. That's just one of them, as you know. There are all sorts of other things. But if you get in the system, you've got skin in the game. If you get in the system, you get a voice at the table, even if you have to force your way to the table. And I'm glad I said it, that this high up person in justice said to me, you have more influence than I have, Steve, because like you, everybody's struggling with the system. You know, everyone, my daughter struggles with the health system, that she can only spend 10 minutes with a person when she wants to spend time with them. Do you know, more time with them? So what you need is people who band together, work together, and then challenge the system bit by bit by bit by bit, which is why what's happening in Britwell is fantastic, because it will do that.
Yeah, and just bringing it back, because I think we have to finish now, but what it reminded me of when you were saying that, you know, there's so much to do and it can feel so overwhelming, of course, and we're talking about one aspect, and there's so many different things, and all of you will probably have personal experiences of a system that's struggling and buckling under the pressure and all of that. I remember I mentioned the boy Elton who was killed in Slough in 2019, and I remember a week after he was killed, my friend was working at that time for a business partnership organization where we've got the biggest trading estate in Europe in Slough. All the big companies have got HQ there, Reckitt and O2 and lots of others, Mars of course, one of our best exports, Mars. And she said to me, why don't you come to this? It was like their AGM. So bear in mind, this is me feeling really raw and upset about what's happened. I go to this wonderful event where they're talking about all of these companies doing their corporate social responsibility and organising a team building event for their staff to go and paint a fence that's probably been painted about 10 times already that year, but they go and paint it again because it's a good thing for volunteers to do. So I got more and more frustrated with what I felt like was just irrelevance based on the fact that I'm sitting in this emotion of this 15-year-old boy being killed by a 15-year-old boy literally half a mile away a week before. So I stood up in the Q&A bit. They didn't know me because I've never been before. And I got very emotional and I said, look, all of what you're saying is great, the weed in the gardens and the paint in the fences, but I need to just say that last week, a 15-year-old boy was killed half a mile away from here, and you're all from big companies. What are any of you doing to look after boys like that? Mm. Where's the mentoring? Where's the opportunity? Where's the opening doors for them? All those boys that were in that park that day are not getting those opportunities. That's what you all need to be doing. And of course everyone, oh, you're absolutely right, and thank you for saying it and all of that, and came to me in the break, and oh, it's so moving what you said and blah blah blah. What happened? Nothing. All those apart from now in Britwell, I had a meeting with someone from Reckitt last week, and I said to her, if you want volunteers to come to Britwell, I'm not interested in you coming to paint a fence, by the way. And she goes, oh, thank you for saying that. So what's happening in October, 20 of their staff are coming to our secondary school to do proper work with people like Elton who don't normally get those opportunities. For me, that's the kind of stuff I mean. Like, we can only do so much. It feels overwhelming. And, you know, one young person has come to Oasis, and surely more and more will come. But the learning, I think, that will come from it, and the proving of what you can do with a young person, because in a way, we don't want anyone coming, because you want people to not do it in the first place, right? That's really the point. So I think we all can just do what we can, but using these kind of examples. And I think what Steve has demonstrated today and always does is the working with the system, but also challenging them with a smile, which is what he's really, really good at, right? And so we need to all be taking lessons from that. There's loads of stuff that we can all do bit by bit by bit in our local area, join it up, stay connected. And, you know, together we really can have an impact.
Yes. Yeah, we can have an impact. And linking to that, just in one sentence at the end, you see, when a young person emerges from Oasis Restore or from Feltham or from wherever, Cook and Wood or Oak Hill or whatever, you know, actually what they need is ongoing mentoring and care. Because the most dangerous day for any young person in the justice system is the day they leave. So they need mentoring and care. The most dangerous moment for any child in a secondary school is 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, because that is when you get stabbed. That's when you get into a fight. So you need people to run after school clubs, and you need mentors to go in, trusted adults. And that's exactly what we're using in the justice, youth justice system. Kids are often locked in a room for 20 hours a day. Do you know why that happens? Because it's cheap. You know, if you're running a wing, we don't run wings, but if you're running a wing and they're all out through the evening, you know, playing chess or playing football or whatever they're doing, you need a lot of people to look after that. Lock the door on them all. You only need two people to run the whole unit. So with the same budget, how are we managing to not lock them up and leave them to get on with enrichment stuff, stuff they enjoy through the evening? Shall I tell you what it is? Volunteers. Football club, netball club, chess club, film club, music club, studios, production, etc. So that these young people, when they finally go back to their rooms, they are knackered at the end of a great day, because that's how it should be for young people. And we can do that together at every level across society. Young people need love to be seen and heard. How do you reduce knife crime? How do you reduce youth violence? You double up on inclusion. That's it. You never reduce knife crime. You never halve knife crime by trying to halve knife crime. You'll halve knife crime by doubling inclusion, running youth groups, listening to people, caring for people. Anyway, I ought to shut up.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.